From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. What does it mean when your can of tuna says, dolphin safe? And why does the United States have an embargo against tuna caught by Mexican fishing boats? Coming up, we speak with an environmental activist, an environmental lawyer, and the president of the Tuna Association of Mexico. Also, travel writer Mary Morris tells us what it's like to travel alone and pregnant through China and the Soviet Union. And we make a visit to the Max Factor Museum of Beauty in Hollywood. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The House is debating competing civil rights bills today. Democrats say they're confident their anti-job discrimination measure will pass, but they need a wide voting margin to ensure it can pass over a threatened presidential veto. The White House held firm today to its statement that the Democrats' bill is a quota bill, which would push employers to hire on the basis of race. But House leaders say the president is unfair in accusing them of encouraging hiring quotas because a specific part of their bill explicitly outlaws the use of quotas. President Bush today made it clear in a meeting with at least a dozen key senators from both parties that he wants no conditions attached to renewing China's most favored nation trading status. NPR's Daryl Johnson reports the president's firm no-strings stand has irked the chairman of the House Human Rights Caucus.
Congressman Tom Lantos, at a rally on Capitol Hill today, praised President Bush for speaking out against repression in the Soviet Union, Romania, South Africa, and other countries, but feels Bush is dead wrong in pushing for a renewal of preferential trade status for China.
Now, there are some who, for the temporary and fleeting benefit of trade, would sell their soul. But the soul of the American people is not for sale. The soul of the American people is with the people of China, all of the people of China, not the handful of dictators who run the show.
According to White House spokesman Marlon Fitchwater, the president feels the best way to engage economic and political reform in China is to, quote, stay engaged. On Capitol Hill, I'm Daryl Johnson.
In Algeria, at least five people were killed in clashes between police and members of the Muslim Fundamentalist Opposition Party. The police used tear gas and live ammunition in some cases to try and break up the protests. Leaders of the Muslim Opposition Party are demanding the resignation of President Shadli Benjedid of the ruling National Liberation Front. The BBC's Peter Hyatt reports from Algiers.
The worst of today's clashes took place near the square of the 1st of May, one of the two squares which police in the early hours of this morning cleared of the hundreds of fundamentalists who had been occupying it for a week. There, eyewitnesses say, police opened fire with rubber bullets and live ammunition, though the government denies it. The square remains ringed by riot police, though fundamentalists have retaken possession of Martyrs Square, the other square from which they were evacuated during the night. No police are visible there, but they are present in large numbers outside the nearby headquarters of the ruling FLN. The building is virtually besieged by thousands of fundamentalists shouting, "Shadli is a murderer," and "the FLN are thieves." Police attempts to clear them away with tear gas did not seem to be succeeding.
The BBC's Peter Hyatt. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed today. The Dow lost 7 points to close at 3027.95. Advances narrowly edged out declines in active trading. This is NPR. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney says the United States will sell attack helicopters to the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. Apparently, the UAE will receive 20 powerful Apache helicopters, and Bahrain will get 6. This is the second arms sale to a Mideast country since President Bush announced his arms control proposal last week. The United States plans to sell weaponry to Israel. At the trial of Walter Moody, who's accused of killing a federal judge in Alabama and a civil rights attorney in Georgia, is underway in St. Paul, Minnesota. A jury was selected and sworn in this morning. Opening statements in the case were heard. We have more from Mark Zedeklik of Minnesota Public Radio.
In his opening statement, federal prosecutor Howard Shapiro described Walter Moody as a man who had a vendetta against black organizations and against the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals that refused to overturn his 1972 conviction of possessing a pipe bomb. Shapiro told jurors that Moody was at war with the court and that he carefully planned his attacks with pipe bombs through the mail that killed a judge on the court and a Georgia civil rights attorney. Shapiro told jurors he'll introduce several witnesses who will help show Moody is guilty of the pipe bombings, including estranged wives and girlfriends of Moody. Defense attorney Edward Tolley told jurors that the government's case is full of holes and is more fiction than fact. Tolley also told the court that government witnesses in the case are unreliable. The trial of Walter Moody is expected to last 3 to 4 weeks. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Sedeklik in St. Paul.
NASA repaired a small patch of insulation on the external fuel tank of the Columbia, and engineers ran tests to see if the glue would dry in time for the shuttle to be launched tomorrow. The space shuttle is supposed to lift off at 8 a.m. tomorrow on a biomedical research mission that has already been postponed 2 times. Attorney General Dick Thornburgh will step down at the end of July. He plans to run for the unexpired Senate term of John Hines, who was killed in a plane crash in April. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many Americans buy tuna fish that says "dolphins safe" on the can. That label is intended to indicate that the tuna have been caught in ways that do not harm dolphins in the process. The U.S. currently has an embargo against tuna caught by Mexican fishing boats because Americans claim too many dolphins are killed. This embargo has been the subject of controversy in international trade relations. In the next few minutes, we'll hear from an environmentalist and an environmental lawyer who've worked for the Dolphin Safe labeling and support the embargo. We'll also hear from a Mexican fisherman who feels his country is being unfairly punished. First, environmentalist Sam Labuddy. He's a biologist with the Earth Island Institute. In 1987, Labuddy took a job on a tuna fishing boat in Mexico registered under Panama. His secret motive was to make a videotape that would document the slaughter of dolphins in the tuna fishing process. He succeeded, and the tape popularized the movement to protect dolphins. He told me how he kept the captain and crew from being suspicious of his motives.
I basically told him the truth, that I was a biologist who was somewhat disillusioned with some aspects of the American way of life, who wanted to learn Spanish and see the Amazon and the Andes, and that I thought that by getting a job on a tuna boat, I could work my way south and make some money. And about 20 minutes before we left, actually, I showed up with this little 8-millimeter video camera and said, "Hey, guys, look at this neat toy my wealthy retired father has given me so he can see all the things that his firstborn son's going to do that he'll never get to see." It's a little bit like writing a fiction. You have to get a contract with your, you know, readers, and after you establish that, you can pretty much lead them just about anywhere. So I basically just took home movies for 4 months on board this vessel and observed what happened and watched them routinely hunt down and kill hundreds and hundreds of dolphins in the course of their fishing operations.
Describe what you consider to be some of the most important tape that you shot. Describe what you saw.
I think perhaps the most important segment was a start-to-finish documentation of this school of 50 common dolphins that we caught. And I remember how very beautiful and perfect they seem, leaping out of the water side by side, mothers and children together. Very much like an extended family, they would all come up and cycle for air at the same time and then disappear for a couple minutes, I believe probably looking for a way out of the net. And what happened during this fishing operation was that we killed every one of them. They were all drowned, and at one point they were very close to the side of the boat, trapped under the net, trying to force enough slack in the net so they could clear their blowholes out of the water and breathe. And we drowned every one of these animals. There was also footage that showed us we got about 1,500 Costa Rican spinner dolphins inside the net one day. And I mean, there were only supposed to be 9,000 of these animals in the entire world in 1980, and we killed hundreds of them. We probably wiped out 5 to 10% of this one species in the course of a single afternoon because we were trying to catch tuna. And as it turned out, we only caught, like, I believe it was one large yellowfin tuna in that entire operation and killed, as I said, 5 to 10% of this, you know, the world population of this species. It was just... I mean, it's hard to describe in words, but if you can imagine somebody trying to, what it looks like to drown a regiment of cavalry at sea, or to watch hundreds of these animals that, you know, have brains as large or larger than human beings being systematically hunted down, maimed, tortured, wrapped up in the nets, crushed in the machinery, and just treated like so much, I don't know, garbage. It was very depressing. I many times felt like something inside of me was dying. It was almost spiritually crippling to see how little respect that human beings could have for sentient life.
Can you describe why tuna fishing, why a certain approach to tuna fishing ends up killing dolphins?
Well, there's in the eastern tropical Pacific, that's the part of the Pacific Ocean off the west coast of Central America and Mexico, there's a biological anomaly where these large adult yellowfin tuna that we eat as light tuna school up underneath herds of dolphins. This is a relationship between the dolphins and the tuna that doesn't take place anywhere else in the world to any significant degree. And about 30 years ago, the fishermen, rather than throwing live bait into the water when they would see the dolphins and tuna swimming together and working the tuna into a feeding frenzy where they would bite at anything that moved, including the unbaited hooks that the fishermen would dangle over the side of the boat, about 30 years ago, somebody decided, wow, if we put a giant mile-long net all the way around the dolphin herd, a circular wall of net that's very deep, and close it from the bottom, we can catch all the tuna at once. And the problem was that there was no provision or forethought given to the livelihood of the dolphins. And as a consequence, they started killing about 500,000 dolphins a year and have absolutely decimated several populations of Pacific dolphins as a consequence. This is an unnecessary and easy to see a very brutal way to fish for tuna fish. It accounts presently for only about 2 or 3% of the total annual harvest of the world's tuna. And there's lots of other alternatives to not, you know, engender the whole-scale slaughter of the dolphin populations. It's just a way for some very wealthy fishermen to make more money faster.
My guest is environmentalist Sam Labuddy. Now, let me see if I have this straight. Basically, yellowfin tuna swim beneath dolphins. So if you sight the dolphins, you'll know the tuna are underneath, and they end up, a certain kind of netting technique ends up getting both the dolphins and the tuna. Is there any way of letting the dolphins go when you net the dolphins with the tuna?
Well, one of the problems is that even when there have been attempts to develop things called backdown procedures to let the dolphins out of the net once they're captured, but the problem is that the dolphins start dying as a consequence of this type of fishing even before they're inside the nets. For a dolphin who's dolphins are communities. Their ability to survive in an environment that is hostile to mammalian life depends on their coherence as a social unit. And when you start chasing them with speedboats, when you start buzzing them with helicopters, when you start jamming their sonar with sonar equipment on board the vessels and throwing explosives at them and chasing them, what happens is you pretty much start tearing asunder the fabric of that community. You start breaking down their ability to maintain their defensive posture in this environment that is filled with sharks and where they depend on one another to forage for food and to survive. And so what happens is in the course of, before these dolphins are even in the nets, you have things happening like mothers spontaneously aborting fetuses. They stop lactating. Newborn dolphins and some of the older dolphins get separated from the herd. Many times the herd will fragment and they'll lose each other. And so what happens is even before these dolphins are captured in the net, you already have a certain level of mortality and attrition going on to the herd.
Some tuna fish now says dolphin safe on the label. What does that mean?
It means that those companies and that do not purchase, process, manufacture, or pack any tuna caught in ways that are known to kill dolphins. It means that companies like H.J. Heinz, Starkist, which is the biggest tuna company in the world and which was the first company to announce a dolphin-safe policy, will not buy, process, or sell, or pack, or touch in any way any tuna that was caught by purse seining on dolphins, with drift nets, with gill nets, or with any other fishing technology that is known to kill dolphins. And this is a policy. These are policies that are international in their scope. It means they affect all sister, parent, and affiliate companies of Heinz Starkist, for instance. And it means that these companies have passed the criteria that was established by Earth Island Institute and the other 40 groups of the Dolphin Coalition in Washington, D.C.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sam Labuddy. He's an environmentalist, and he's been at the forefront of the movement to prevent the killing of dolphins in tuna nets. A few years ago, he went undercover on a Mexican tuna boat under a Panamanian flag, and he filmed tuna fishing expeditions in which dolphins were killed or maimed, and that footage helped lead to an American embargo against tuna from countries that use a netting technique, which ends up killing dolphins. Sam Labuddy now is a biologist with the environmental group Earth Island Institute. We'll take a short break, then we'll be back, and we'll be joined as well by Josh Flom, who's an environmental lawyer. This is Fresh Air. With me is environmentalist Sam Labuddy, and also with us is Josh Flom, an environmental lawyer who just got back from the GATT talks in Geneva. GATT stands for the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, and he went there in support of the Marine Mammal Protection Act. Josh Flom, what are the United States regulations now surrounding tuna fishing?
Well, one of the things that Sam did with his very powerful film is he went to Congress and graphically illustrated to Congress the types of things that were actually going out there in the high seas. As a result of Congress being aware of the type of carnage that was going on, in 1988, it amended the Marine Mammal Protection Act to really toughen up the law and to provide environmental lawyers with some ammunition to try to do something to stop the dolphin slaughter. One of the things that Congress did in 1988 was to implement a law which would mandate the embargo of tuna imports from countries who slaughtered dolphins in numbers far exceeding those of the U.S. fleet.
Right now, the United States has an embargo against the countries that use the netting technique that kills a lot of dolphins during the process of tuna fishing. Now that embargo was recently extended against countries that import tuna from countries that use these netting techniques, can the tuna and export it to the United States, right?
That's correct.
So some of the countries that import the tuna, can it, and export it back to the United States, include Japan, France, and Italy. Now, this has all come up at the GATT talks, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. What's the controversy in the GATT talks over these embargoes?
Well, the Bush administration opposed us in U.S. federal court when we got these embargoes in the first place. And what happened after the tuna from Mexico, from Venezuela, and Vanuatu was embargoed because those countries killed hundreds of thousands of dolphins each year, even though largely as a result of Earth Island's efforts, the kill rate for the U.S. fleet has gone down dramatically. Mexico decided that it would stop seeking help from the Bush administration to fight us in U.S. federal court and instead challenged the entire U.S. law at GATT. GATT is a free trade agreement, and it was originally signed by some 100 countries back in the 40s when there really wasn't a whole lot of environmental awareness. Mexico brought a petition in front of a three-judge GATT panel contending that the U.S. law violated the free trade agreement because it prohibited free trade. The U.S. law would not allow them to export their tuna to the United States because they were killing too many dolphins. And Mexico essentially argued that there is no room for environmentalism in the context of global trade. So we had to escalate our battle to save the dolphins, if you will, from U.S. federal court and in the U.S. appellate courts, because we've been opposed every step of the way by U.S. fishermen, foreign fishermen, and unfortunately the very government officials who should be protecting dolphins. We've had to go defend the U.S. law at GATT, and I was in Geneva several weeks ago, and that was my purpose.
So Mexico is making the case that this embargo against the tuna fishing process that kills dolphins really is a violation of free trade laws.
Mexico argues that you, United States, you might have tougher environmental laws than us. You might have higher environmental morality than us, if you will. But who are you to impose your worldview on us? After all, there are dolphins. They swim off the coast of our waters. And you should not be able to legislate extraterritorially, is how they put it. The problem with Mexico's argument is that if one accepts that notion, that domestic laws and treaty laws that restrict free trade violate GATT, then a whole range of environmental laws, which are very important to the world and to us, would also be in danger. For example, you might be familiar with CITES, which is the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. That was the vehicle used to ban the ivory trade. The European community has a law that prohibits the importation of baby fur seal skins because people all around the world were outraged when they saw film of people clubbing baby fur seals to death just for their pelts. All of those laws would fall by the wayside if one accepts the argument that you cannot restrict free trade for environmental purposes, and I think that would be a shame. I expect the GATT court to rise to this historic occasion. This is the first time that environmental law has ever been before GATT, to find that in some instances, short-term profits have to give way to the environment. And I think in the long term, not only does it help the environment, but it will help the world economy.
Josh Flom is an attorney with the Earth Island Institute and the Marine Mammal Fund. We also heard from environmental activist Sam Labuddy. We called Felipe Chirat. He's a Mexican fisherman and the president of the Tuna Association of Mexico. He says the dolphin population is really growing every year, and environmentalists are exaggerating the threat that tuna fishing poses to dolphins. He told me that Mexico is being unfairly punished by the tuna embargo.
The United States has a quota on the number of dolphins that can be killed in the fisheries with tuna. That number of dolphins is a unilateral and arbitrary decision made in Washington at the political level. It has absolutely no relationship in the basis of science. It has absolutely no relationship whatsoever in international law. Let's talk about science. The dolphin population in the eastern tropical Pacific is anywhere from 8 to 12 million dolphins. A U.S. administrative judge decided that 10 million was a number to be used. The gross reproduction rate of dolphins in the eastern tropical Pacific is 11%. The net reproduction rate is 4%. Therefore, approximately 400,000 dolphins will increase each year. The total dolphin mortality in the eastern tropical Pacific for 1991, if the year continues the way it started, according to the Inter-American Tropical Tuna Commission, will probably not exceed 40,000 dolphins. The dolphin population in the eastern tropical Pacific is growing, so much so that in January, in La Jolla, California, the National Marine Fisheries Service, which has had an ongoing program to monitor the evolution and the trend in the population of dolphins in the eastern tropical Pacific, came to the conclusion that the stocks were doing well enough and the trend was good enough that they no longer needed to monitor it every year and to make use of those funds for other purposes. That proposition was submitted to a vote and was approved by the powers to be in La Jolla. So the same U.S. government is no longer concerned about the trend in the population of dolphins, so much so that they've given up monitoring it and have decided to make use of the funds for other purposes.
Is your group trying to do anything to pressure the United States to end the embargo against Mexican tuna?
We are trying to communicate to the United States that the decisions they've made are incorrect, both in the basis of science and in the basis of law. The United States is a sovereign nation. It can do what it wants to within its own borders and with its own fleet. We do not believe, according to international law, that the United States can unilaterally tell the world what it must do. These things are generally agreed to as multilateral agreements. And when what the United States does flies in the face of science, then you're adding insult to injury.
You still run tuna fishing vessels, yes?
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the tuna fishing technique you use?
I use the very same technique that has been evolved and used by the American boat owners and the American fleet. And the net result is that we have as efficient a release rate right now in 1991 as the U.S. fleet. However, what I do want to communicate to you is that in order to fish successfully in the eastern tropical Pacific, we must do it by setting on dolphins. If we cannot do it by setting on dolphins, two things happen. First of all, the fisheries is economically unsustainable. And what I'm saying is no longer a question of hypotheses or theory. The fact of the matter is that until April of 12, 1990, there were 29 American vessels fishing in the eastern tropical Pacific. As a result of the decision made, there are right now only three vessels left fishing for tuna in the eastern tropical Pacific by the U.S. fleet. We also find fascinating the fact that other countries, such as Japan, have fisheries who dedicate their effort ex professo only to fishing on dolphins, which they then sell in their internal markets. I have received many letters from environmental groups in the United States soliciting funds so that dolphins can be saved. I have heard Starkist announce publicly that they did not believe that a single dolphin should die. At the same time, we know that there are nations who fish and kill tens of thousands of dolphins. I have yet to hear an environmental group or a commercial company saying, do not buy Toyotas until the Japanese stop killing dolphins. And this dichotomy, this express focus only on Mexico, without focusing on anything else that's going on in the world, and we in Mexico, who are doing everything we can to minimize the dolphin mortality and assure that the dolphin population grows while trying to feed our people, create jobs, and create currency to pay our debts, are being punished. And the other people who fish on purpose on dolphins, or who do not have observers and work without people knowing what is happening, are being rewarded. And their tune is called Dolphin Safe, because there's nobody there to tell them exactly what happened. It seems to us to be rank discrimination, unfair, unscientific, and illegal.
Felipe Sherratt is the president of the Tuna Association of Mexico. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When novelist and travel writer Mary Morris planned a trip to the Soviet Union 5 years ago, her friends warned her not to go. She was of childbearing age, and the nuclear accident at Chernobyl had just happened, spreading radiation around her destination. But Morris went to the Soviet Union and discovered during the trip that she was pregnant. Coming up, Mary Morris tells us about traveling alone and pregnant, and how traveling has changed now that she has a family to take along. Also, how an immigrant barber changed the faces of American women. We visit the Max Factor Museum of Beauty in Hollywood. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, the House is now debating the Civil Rights Bill of 1991. Tonight, the House is expected to vote on 2 out of 3 competing versions of the measure. NPR's Mara Liasson has more.
The first 2 versions of the bill, a liberal version backed by the Congressional Black Caucus and some women's groups, and a White House-backed version, are both expected to fail. Tomorrow, the House will finish debate by considering a compromise version backed by the House Democratic leadership. That version would overturn a series of Supreme Court decisions that made it harder for women and minorities to sue employers for discrimination. Although the bill explicitly outlaws quotas and allows victims of hiring quotas to sue for damages, President Bush and the Republicans continue to insist the bill would force employers to use quotas in hiring to avoid being sued. The president has threatened to veto the bill. The Democratic bill is expected to pass by a wide margin, but it is unlikely to receive the 288 votes it would need to withstand a presidential veto. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Israeli warplanes hit Palestinian bases in southern Lebanon for the 2nd day in a row. According to reports, more than a dozen people were killed and at least 35 others were injured. 15 Israeli airplanes dropped at least 95 rockets in 10 different raids, hitting bases more than 20 miles south of Beirut. In Washington, the Bush administration said today that it is comfortable that Iraq no longer has the ability to build nuclear weapons. This statement comes after an NPR report that a man claiming to be Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein's top nuclear scientist had defected to U.S. troops, saying that Allied bombing did not destroy all of Iraq's nuclear capability. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
U.S. military planners made Iraq's nuclear capacity a primary target of the Allied bombing raids that began January 18th, but the Iraqi scientist told American military interrogators that a lot of the targets survived the intense Allied bombing. Pentagon spokesman Bob Hall, however, says Saddam Hussein no longer poses a nuclear threat.
I feel comfortable that they don't have the capability of producing nuclear weapons now. Part of what we're trying to do is to make sure they don't, recover that ability.
Hall says an international team of inspectors is heading back to Iraq as part of the process to determine what may be left of Iraq's nuclear facilities. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
UN forces have taken over the last mountain camp for Kurdish refugees on the Turkish-Iraqi border. The military says that some 60 U.S. soldiers at the camp will leave tomorrow. They have been there for about 6 weeks. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 7 points to close at 3,027.95 in very active trading. This is NPR News. President Bush has nominated Robert Strauss to be U.S. ambassador to Moscow. Strauss is a former chairman of the Democratic National Committee, and he served as international trade representative for President Carter. Mr. Bush made his announcement as the U.S. and Soviet Union worked toward agreement on a treaty to cut long-range nuclear weapons and to forge closer economic ties. The French government said today that despite its decision to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, France will continue to carry out its nuclear test in the South Pacific. Lynn Terry has more from Paris.
French Foreign Minister Roland Dumas told an assembly of European parliamentarians that non-proliferation is one thing, but the defense of the country is another. France now carries out 6 tests a year. The program was started under President Charles de Gaulle, who refused to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty in 1968 because he feared it would compromise the independence of France's defense. Yesterday, however, the French government reversed that decision in its global disarmament plan. The plan says that nuclear disarmament is an essential objective, and it calls for reductions in arsenals worldwide. The government also reiterated a 1983 proposal to reduce its stockpiles as soon as the U.S. and Soviet arsenals are brought down to the French level. The French tests have strained France's relations with Australia and New Zealand. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
In New York City, as far as ticket sales go, Broadway has just reported its second-best season ever, despite fewer shows and smaller audiences. Ticket sales dropped less than 6% compared to the $283 million reported for the 1989-90 season. One reason for this, ticket prices went up by $5 to a top of $60 for musicals and $100 for choice seats for Miss Saigon. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Mary Morris is one of the few but growing number of women travel writers. She doesn't see herself as an adventurer, but as an observer, a storyteller. Notes from Morris's journals about her travels in Mexico and Central America became the book Nothing to Declare, Memoirs of a Woman Traveling Alone. In her new travel book, Morris writes that the first foreign country she ever visited was her grandmother's house. Although her grandmother lived in downtown Chicago, the sounds, stories, and smells of her native Russia filled the house. In 1986, Morris planned a trip to her grandmother's village near Kiev. Morris planned to travel through China and the Soviet Union. The journey is recounted in Morris's new book, Wall to Wall, From Beijing to Berlin by Rail. The trip was set to begin 10 days after the Chernobyl nuclear accident. At the time, Morris was 40 and hoping to have a child sometime in the near future. Her women friends, fearful of the effects of radioactivity, urged her not to go. Her male friends told her to go.
This was going to be my last hurrah. This was going to be the trip that I was going to take before I settled down to have a child. It didn't mean that I wasn't going to travel again, but I saw this in terms of traveling alone for a long time. This was going to kind of be it. And I really did this survey of all my women friends, and everyone said, without a doubt, if you want to have a child, don't go. And all the men said, go. And it really was interesting, except for the shoemaker, my Russian shoemaker, and my doctor. My doctor said, don't go. But I went, so that was that.
When you decided to not go to Kiev because of the radiation from Chernobyl,
right.
It was difficult for you to change your travel plans because of all the Soviet bureaucratic things that were involved. So you made up a story that you were pregnant, figuring that this they would respect. You didn't realize you actually were pregnant at the time.
Well, truthfully, Terry, the minute I said it, I knew. It was that kind of thing where, I had made up many excuses to various women from Intours to try to get my itinerary changed, and I finally thought, okay, I'll tell this woman I'm pregnant. And the minute I said it, it was quite clear to me that, in fact, I was going to have a child.
When you realized that you were pregnant, you decided you wanted to get married to your companion of 3 years, who you knew as the father. But he was where at the time when you had this realization?
He was in New York. I think he was in New York en route to New Zealand. Actually, I don't know if this is in the book, but when I called him and told him that I really thought I was pregnant and I wasn't going to the Ukraine and that I really wanted to have the child, I think things happened a little bit differently than the way I wrote them in the book. I had to kind of compress some things, but he basically thought I was kind of making it up. So it wasn't until I talked to him a little bit later that I told him I wasn't making it up that things kind of fell apart between us. It was clear to me that he was not really interested in going in this direction.
What was it like for you to be alone on the road, finding out you're pregnant and realizing that your relationship is going to fall apart too?
It was probably the loneliest moment of my life. It was really a kind of moment of reckoning. And I draw analogies with Anna Karenina and, you know, her sense of, I really felt the solitude of women. I mean, I don't really know how else to say that. I mean, I was very alone. I didn't have any of my network of friends or people or anyone I could talk to. And, you know, I was just very isolated with this knowledge and also debating what I was going to do about it. I mean, I don't think it's that easy for a woman who's very, very close to 40 to be in that situation no matter what. I have many friends facing similar situations. I felt very connected to women at that moment and yet very alone because there wasn't anyone there to talk to.
You considered an abortion. Can I ask you, when you were making, like, your mental lists about why to have the baby and why to have an abortion, what those lists look like?
Well, money was right up there with them, I guess, and also, could I manage? I mean, I didn't really have a sense of the reality of what taking care of a child alone would be like. And also, I had lived my life in a very free way. I had gone where I wanted, when I wanted, and the thought of the constraints on my freedom, my personal freedom, weighed very heavily on me. But on the other hand, I think something was happening inside of me. I mean, this trip, unlike Nothing to Declare, which was really a trip about being a woman alone, it's single, solitary, I was really looking for family in Wall to Wall. And I think that finding that I, in fact, was going to have a family was part of the journey.
Did you treat yourself differently when you knew you were pregnant?
I stopped drinking vodka. That was my main thing, which is not that easy to do in the Soviet Union because people are always offering vodka to you. In fact, when I got back to the United States, I told my doctor I was very concerned because I had done a lot of drinking in the Soviet Union, and he said, God, I hope it wasn't water because of the Chernobyl situation. And I said, no, it was vodka. He said, well, I'm sure you'll be fine. And I was, yeah, I mean, I think women just in general, I mean, I had never been pregnant before, but I remembered feeling sort of like I wanted to protect myself and be kind of safe and curled up. And of course, it's pretty difficult when you're, you know, on a pretty intense journey, but I felt that that's what I wanted to do. I didn't exactly do it, but I did the best I could.
My guest is travel writer Mary Morris. Her new book is Wall to Wall, From Beijing to Berlin by Rail. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Travel writer and novelist Mary Morris is my guest. Now you're married to,
yes,
to someone who's not the father of your daughter.
Right.
Your new book is part of a series of books about being a woman traveling. And your first two books are about being a woman alone traveling. The books that you're in the process of writing or are conceiving now are about traveling with your daughter and then traveling as a family.
Right.
When you were traveling on this trip that your new book is about, through China and the Soviet Union, what was the typical reaction you'd get from men and women to being a woman alone? Did they think that that was unusual?
The Chinese can't cope with it. They want to know where your group is and why they don't get it, why you'd be alone, because they always go in a group. You know, they have to have the group. And the Russians also, they have a hard time understanding why you're not, you know, with a bunch of people. I think for me the most, extreme example of this was the Soviet border guards, the women that came into my compartment and took my high heels and held them in my face and said, why are you traveling alone with high heels, assuming that I was a prostitute, because that's what they would think a prostitute would do. They couldn't imagine a woman alone might have to go to a dinner party once in a while, you know. So, yeah, I think there were some, you know, complicated issues about it for me.
Did you ever feel physically threatened on this trip through China and the Soviet Union?
No, not on this trip. No, I found the Chinese and the Eastern Europeans and the Soviets extremely respectful of women, and I think it comes out of the kind of society that they have. I mean, if they're not, you know, I think capitalism and money and things like that do funny things to the way people view women. And, you know, I think America is probably the most violent society vis-a-vis women that I've ever traveled in. I would never travel alone in America.
Why not?
I feel threatened here. I mean, I'll travel around New York, or I'll go from, you know, I mean, I won't travel the way I've traveled. I probably by car, for example. I mean, I just think there are strange things out there in America, much stranger than in the Soviet Union. I mean, I had a cab driver take me all over the outskirts of Moscow we were together for about 6 hours. Then when I went to Voznesensky's house, and he brought me back at around 2 a.m. And I didn't feel threatened for 1 minute, you know, and I was sitting in the front seat and trying to talk to him in Russian, and he was a young guy, and it just, there's something about them. Women are not objects to them in the same way I think that they are here. I mean, this is a very superficial comment I'm making. I mean, I don't really know the deeper psychological structures of the society, but I just know what I read in the newspaper, and it just seems to me that America is a much more dangerous place.
Some people have trouble enjoying the experience when they're traveling alone. Because there's nobody to...
It's lonely. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's no one to have little in-jokes with and to describe things with and so on. Do you enjoy it less when you're alone, or are there things that are so fulfilling about traveling alone that compensate for that?
You know, it's funny, because this trip was in 86, and now it's 1991, and I haven't been alone in 5 years.
Right.
I'd love to be alone. I'm going to go on tour with this book, and I'm going to be alone for a week. I think there's just different, you know, it's definitely, you know, sitting in a restaurant and eating a meal alone is not a lot of fun, or... you know, walking around a city alone late at night. It's just, it's not a whole lot of fun, but I think you have a certain freedom and perception of the world that's different when you have that solitude, you know, the solitude of self. But on the other hand, you know, you have to deal with people when you're with them. I mean, I think my next book is going to be about traveling through the Southwest with my family. I mean, we went for 2 months in a van with a teenager and my teenage nephew and my daughter and my husband. And, you know, that was just a very different kind of vacation. You know, I can't call it a vacation. Whatever it was very different than being alone. I think there's just trade-offs, you know, no matter what.
What are some of the things you liked about traveling with a family?
Oh, truthfully, Terry?
Yeah, truthfully.
I love traveling with my husband, but, I mean, the things about, well, okay, I guess one of the things about traveling with a family, children bring things to you, and it really is amazing. I mean, one thing that happened to us when we spent a whole year, 1990, traveling through the Southwest, and, I mean, when I say that, I'm always writing, and I always have other things going on, but when we were on the road a lot of the time. And we would spend an enormous amount of time at Native American ceremonial dances and things like that. And once I remember I had my daughter in my arms, and we were sort of walking through the village, and the Indians were giving an offering they had. And they were all in their costumes, and they were going into the square with their offering. And we said hello to a dancer who was very beautifully dressed, and my, you know, Katie was in my arms, and we smiled at this dancer. And he turned around and he gave us his offering, which was a beautiful pair of rawhide earrings. Because I think she had made contact with him, and he gave us his gift. And I think there's something about being with children, they kind of break down some barriers. I mean, I found, particularly with Native Americans, you know, we'd go into a village with our daughter, and people would start to talk to us, whereas I think if we were just alone, there's just a different feeling about being with an adult or just being adults. There's some barriers that get broken down there. So.
Okay, what's the other side, though, about traveling with a baby? You said that,
it's difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, just practically, I mean, there's, you know, I mean, I think one of the things that I have found about being a mother and a writer and a traveler is that you have to really weigh the trade-offs. I mean, there's things that I would really love to do that just aren't fair to the child. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would, you know, get in a car and drive for 10 hours to get to some obscure part of the Navajo reservation to see a dance that no one's ever seen before. Well, you know, that's just not really fair to a 3 or 4 year old child to do that. You know, our daughter used to get up every morning and look at us groggily and say, where are we going now? And, you know, I think that, and just practically, you know, there's things you need, you know, milk, diapers, you know, food, certain kinds of things you have to be able to provide, provide for a child. We knew these friends who went to Lithuania for a month, and the suitcase that had all their disposable diapers was lost, and so they had to kind of use cheesecloth, they told me, and they said it was really, not that, I mean, you know, disposable diapers aren't the greatest things in the world, but they had no diapers with them, essentially, and they had to kind of do something makeshift. You know, they're difficulties. Children have needs that are different from adult needs. I mean, I can put up with sleeping on a straw mat and not having great food for a night, but you have to think about your child. You have to think about the water the child's drinking, the food it's eating.
What keeps you traveling?
Well, to be honest, I'm not really traveling so much anymore. I mean, I've always been curious about the world. I've always been a bit restless. I've always wanted to kind of go places. But now I'm feeling more that I want to focus on my own writing and write more fiction and kind of take more internal journeys, a little less than external. But I think way back then what kept me traveling was a real kind of search I was on that's sort of complicated and has to do with things inside of myself and also just a basic curiosity about the world. I mean, I loved it when I did it, you know, but I also think I was kind of, oh, I don't know, looking for something.
Well, in your book, Wall to Wall, that's just been published, you wrote that if you died tomorrow, you didn't know where you'd be buried.
Right.
Because you just didn't have deep enough roots in any one place, and all the family plots were taken up already.
That's true.
Do you still feel that way?
I still don't know where I'll be buried, and I do think about it because I keep thinking, gee, I should have a place where I want to be, you know, where I want my family to be. And it is true that my mother sold my plot to a distant cousin, so I have like no real place. But then I think sometimes it doesn't really matter anyway. We're living in Brooklyn now. I really like it. It really works for us. But I don't really know what home is. You know, home is a complicated notion, I think, in this society. And, you know, maybe it's something I'll always be looking for. Goethe once said that being a writer is about being homesick, you know, and always searching for that place that you remember. And, you know, maybe that's just the way I'll always be.
Do you think that search can continue without being on the road physically searching?
Yeah, I mean, I think now that I have a child and a husband, I feel more that home is an emotional construct rather than a physical, geographical place. I mean, I had always felt the town that I grew up in Illinois was home, but it's not home anymore. I mean, emotionally, it's not home. You know, the connections are not there anymore. So I think it can be a more kind of spiritual thing than a real geographical location.
What do you miss most about the days when you could travel alone?
Well, I think, first and foremost, I'm a writer, and I'm always writing. And I think the thing about being alone on the road is you can just really let your mind wander and your imagination go. And, I mean, I would just take my journals and write for hours and hours and hours on a bus, on a train, or just sitting in a cafe. And I really miss that. That is something I just don't have in my life anymore, that kind of clear mental space, you know, that sort of profound solitude where no one's going to interrupt you, nobody's going to want an ice cream, nobody wants to know what you want to do next. That I really miss. You know, that's kind of hard to get now.
Well, Mary Morris, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Mary Morris's new travel book is called Wall to Wall, From Beijing to Berlin by Rail. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Today on All Things Considered, the Civil Rights Bill is being debated on the floor of the House. Mara Liasson will have a piece on the politics of that debate. We'll attempt to parse the issues that are hiding behind the partisanship. Ann Garrels is in the Soviet Union, and she'll have a report on a town which worked pretty well under the old planned economy, but under the new reforms, it isn't working very well at all. The Attorney General has resigned. The president has not replaced him yet, but he has decided to appoint a Democrat, Robert Strauss, to be the ambassador to Moscow. And Noah Adams has an interview with democracy activist Fang Lizhe of China. That's later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
There are a lot of small museums around the country devoted to Americana and Arcania, museums devoted to the history of vacuum cleaners, fans, checkers, and personalities like Lawrence Welk. Independent producer Harriet Baskis is spending a lot of time these days visiting these museums for a radio series called Henrietta's Holiday. Today she takes us to Hollywood and the Max Factor Museum of Beauty.
Sometimes, on my way to the budget floor at the department store, I pass through the cosmetic section and take the tiny samples that the heavily made-up sales clerks thrust into my hands. I found myself fussing with those makeup samples before I visited the Max Factor Museum of Beauty. Would they take me seriously, or even let me in the door, if I didn't wear makeup? To my relief, the museum curator, Randy Koss, didn't inspect my face as he whisked me past the ornate Art Deco entrance, up the marble stairs, and into a world of makeup, beauty, and illusion.
It turns out that it's more than makeup. Everything Max made related to actors, motion picture, movie industry, it all intertwines with what Hollywood is.
It turns out that the Max and Max Factor was a Jewish barber and wig maker from Germany who came to Hollywood in the early 1900s. He was soon selling wigs and makeup to actors and actresses in the blossoming Hollywood film industry. The traditional heavy stage makeup wasn't working too well under the bright movie lights, so in labs behind his shop, Factor cooked up more useful items like pancake makeup, the eyebrow pencil, color TV makeup, and even lip gloss. Soon, moviegoers who wanted to look like their favorite film star were also coming to Max Factor.
Joan Crawford revolutionized lips because when she took that lip brush and she just painted her whole lip and made her bottom lip even larger. When the women saw this on the stage here in Hollywood, there's newspaper clippings that they ran out of the theater, sat down on the curb, and started reapplying their lips. It just changed everyone's lips. It went, wow, yeah, big lips are in. And of course, they were going out to buy the lip brush to help them try it on, and Max created the lip brush, so he was thrilled.
Factor also tried to perfect a long-lasting lipstick. He tested it by having a pair of employees stand in the middle of the store and kiss each other for hours on end. When they got tired of this, factor replaced them with a mechanical oscillator or kissing machine, which pressed two pairs of rubber lips together under 10 pounds of pressure, the correct pressure, according to Factor, for the perfect kiss. Factor also had a theory about color harmony for women. He decided that women with different hair colors should each have their own makeup combination. So in 1935, he built color-coded makeup rooms and threw a star-studded party to celebrate.
And Jean Harlow was here that night, and she cut the ribbon and dedicated the room for blondes only. And then if you had red hair, you went into a mint green makeup room. And in 1935, Ginger Rogers was a redhead, so she dedicated the room for redheads only. And if you had black hair, you were a brunette, you went into a pink and lavenderish room. And Claudette Colbert was here that night, and she dedicated that makeup room and cut that ribbon.
Max Factor even had a theory about the proportions for a perfect face. The space between your eyes should be equal to the length of one of them. The distance from the top of your forehead to your chin should be three nose lengths long. To measure all this, he invented the beauty calibrator, a machine that looks like a torture device for your head.
It's a structure with lots of metal and copper bands that go around your head. Screws, there must be about 60 screws in it, maybe more. So that whole thing, all it does is measure your face to the 1/1000th of an inch. They were looking for the woman in Hollywood who had the perfect face.
So, did Max ever find a face that measured up?
He didn't want anyone to be perfect because then he couldn't sell them his makeup, right?
On my way out of the museum, for purely journalistic reasons, I stopped by the discount beauty outlet right next door. I passed over the green eyeshadow in favor of invisible foundation, something I still haven't figured out how to use.
Harriet Baskis and her Real Women Productions are based in Seattle. She's producing a radio series about offbeat museums called Henrietta's Holiday. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Joan Tui, with Roberta Shurrock and Robbie Harris. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writing novels versus making movies, we talk with screenwriter, director, and novelist John Sayles. His films include Eight Men Out, Mate One, and The Return of the Secaucus Seven. He has a new novel about Cuban Americans and a new film coming to theaters this summer. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.